Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to the Sage Sayers. I'm your show host, Debbie McCullough. I'm an executive communications coach and narrative coach from New Zealand, based in the fine state of Wisconsin. Every week, the Sage Sayers looks at executive communications tips and strategies, and we interview interesting individuals from all around the world who found gifts, opportunities, and knowledge from difficult or trying situations. My guest this week is Luca Dondi. Luca and I are friends from Positive Intelligence, the coaching and training program, and he's an executive coach based in Rome, Italy. Luca's developed an intriguing niche, helping executives navigate across cultures. And he knows this experience firsthand, having worked and studied in multiple cultures and frequently as a minority, both due to his personality, his life approach, and his nationality too. So Luca, welcome to the Sage Sayers.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Luca. So I wondered first if you could share with my listeners a little bit about your background and your early childhood and where your life began. So is there anything that stands out for you as values, lessons, or any skills that you learned along the way?
So my life began in the northern Italian city of Modena, which is close to Bologna. My early recollections are from the late 1970s, early 1980s. I do remember, for example, American music, which you could listen to on the radio or if you walked into shops, for example, which contributed to me developing a passion for foreign languages. And I also had a grandfather of mine who was fluent in French, and I am fluent as well in this language. And then I remember I was 12, a really bad mark in mathematics. And that was because I had replacement teachers that year, and I did not take that subject seriously. And my parents were furious, and they sent me to private tuition that summer. And from that bad experience, I then developed an analytical mind. So from something which was initially bad, 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 there was a gift. What was a weakness developed into one of my greatest strengths. And then another recollection that I had that I have from adolescence was working in my father's office. My father was, and still is, despite his age, he's 77, a chartered surveyor. And so I used to help him out during the summer part-time. So, and I watched him interact with his clients with his calm, composed manner, his clear mind, and his attention to detail. And I also remember his very clear, very stylish handwriting. So I think, you know, those experiences contributed to the man that I was about to become.
Oh, I love that. How sweet to have these memories with your dad. And I hope you've shared them with him, because that's just such a beautiful takeaway from a young man to view his dad that way. And you have developed into someone resembling the father you just described. You're an ambitious man. You studied economics and business management. You became an exchange student in Glasgow, Scotland. So at what point of your studies did it become clear that business analysis and program management and then consulting would become your path?
Okay, so in retrospect, I think those early experiences with my father were seminal, meaning that my father has an analytical mind, very precise, very disciplined, very organized, very methodical. And by watching him interact with his clients, you absorb quite a lot subconsciously. Once I graduated, I moved to the United Kingdom, where I stayed for about 10, 11 years. And at the beginning of my stay, my English was not comparable to that of a native. So you tend to go into lines of business, for example, business analysis, project management, program management, where English is not as important as, for example, in sales or relationship management. So, but I think those early experiences with my father probably shaped the man that I became.
Beautiful, beautiful. And then as you came back to, you worked with American Express and then MasterCard in Italy, and it was that stage when moving from business analysis to program management, and maybe somewhat also moving back to Italy after your travels abroad, that you started to feel this imposter syndrome and then the challenges of what it feels like when you're functioning and working within a business culture which doesn't resonate with you. I wondered if you could share for me and my listeners what that felt like and then how you knew that something was going on.
So after about 10, 11 years, I moved back to Italy, and that was good in the sense that I reconnected with my home culture. And then from American Express, I moved to MasterCard in Italy, in Rome, to a different function, which is consulting. And although consulting includes an element of analysis, it requires a slightly different skill set. So that was one challenge from which I developed imposter syndrome. But the biggest challenge was moving from one culture to another and experiencing cultural shock. In retrospect, the fact that I moved between cultures, including a stint in the United States, gave me a certain drive to adapt to any situation, but also a knowledge around attitudes on authority and decision-making across cultures. And thirdly, also knowing when to adapt to certain situations and when not to do so. So if you lived and worked abroad, as I have done, you recognize your own culture, you know, what it looks like from a distance. And then you can start saying, well, in this situation, I would like to adapt to that foreign culture. In the next situation, I may keep my own culture. So it gives us options.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it does. And can you give us an example of when you've chosen to adjust and then when you've chosen to not adjust and be the Italian man?
Well, for example, in certain cultures, the attitude towards authority is different. So, for example, in certain countries, people tend to be more egalitarian, meaning that the boss is just a facilitator among equals. So it is okay to disagree with the boss, to challenge the boss. In other cultures, the boss is a director. You do not contradict them. It is inappropriate to do so. You defer to the person in charge. So moving from an Anglo-Saxon country to Italy, then I found myself wondering how direct or indirect can I be with the boss? And there's also in Europe a divide between Catholic countries in the south and Protestant cultures in the north. And Catholic countries tend to be more hierarchical. So in the case of authority, well, sometimes I decided to keep my Anglo-Saxon hat and say, well, it is okay to disagree with the boss, you know, to challenge them, to be direct, although that may not be appropriate in a country like Italy. So I have paid the consequences for that. And in terms of decision-making, okay, so in some cultures, you tend to consult a lot of people before a decision is made, especially in what we call consensual cultures. And once the decision has been made, it is fixed. It is set in stone. So people move quickly to implementation. In other cultures, it is not so consensual. It is more of a top-down culture, meaning that the boss decides. And because the boss may not have consulted a lot of people before making a decision, that decision is flexible, so it can change. So in the case of Italy, you know, decisions can be flexible. They're not set in stone. And so in some cases, I had to adapt myself to this mindset, which may infuriate somebody who comes, for example, from Germany, where there is emphasis on structure, on being punctual, being organized, being on time. So, and once a decision is made, you don't change it. Whereas in Italy, decision is with a small d at the beginning. It's not a capital D. So all these things contributed to myself having to adapt and adjust to a country which had more power distance, meaning that there is an acceptance of an unequal distribution of power. So between you and the boss, you call the boss sir, or, you know, Mr. Director, for example, as you would do, for example, in Germany, but you don't do in the United States. So it's a combination of having that awareness that your home culture needs to be respected and you need in some ways to get along with your boss, but at the same time, retaining in other situations the good sides of a foreign culture, which you have absorbed.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that idea of retaining and bringing in your own culture and the rich parts of you. And that is why your employer hired you, because of those elements, but also being ready to pivot and adopt the culture in which you're operating as well. So it's kind of like a dance. And I wondered if I can share a story of how I've experienced culture shock and imposter syndrome. And then I didn't have a coach back then, but if I share the story, could you perhaps tell me how you might have coached me if I came to you for that help at that time? It's kind of a funny story. So is that okay, Luca?
Perfect.
Okay. So when I moved to the States in 1996, I'd actually moved over from Japan, where I had worked for 4 years and a year in Singapore in the middle of that time. So a total of 5 years working in Asia. And my last year in Tokyo, I was the only foreigner in a company of over 1,000 people. So I had become very, very Japanese in my body language and my mannerisms, even my speech. I had learned to raise my voice an octave, for instance, to show civility and courtesy to my audience, especially when speaking with men. And I had learned to show affirmation through and thanks through bowing. And these were just two examples of the business culture I had absorbed to function and survive in that role, where I was an executive communications translator and secretary for the president in the C-suite. So when I moved to San Francisco, as you can imagine, San Francisco, California, there was a lot of culture shock for me. I mean, looking back, I was 26 years old. This is a long time ago now. But I remember just really feeling completely out of sorts and often thinking, I have no idea how to behave in these moments. And it might be a moment where I'm socially interacting with my new Californian friends who were really bright, but some of them were hippies and they drove a V-dub bus. Or I might have been in a job situation where I was applying to become an executive secretary, but I often just didn't know how to behave. And it was very, very cultural. I would call it more than culture shock. It was cultural confusion. And in the end, what got me through, because I didn't have a coach and I didn't even really know about coaching back then, in the end, I told myself to choose a friend whose communication style I admired because I enjoyed listening to them and I saw them as successful, and sort of fake it until I could make it. So by that, I mean, go into an interview situation and pretend that I was this friend, Jessica was her name, and pretend I was Jessica. And of course, coach myself not to bow when I wanted to say yes, and remind myself not to raise my voice. What would you have done to guide me in that time?
So what negative feelings did you experience when you landed in San Francisco?
Probably the normal fear of arriving somewhere by yourself. I arrived with a backpack and $10,000 of saved money. So fear I could survive and make it, fear that I could secure an H-1B visa, which I went on to do, and then my green card, but fear that my loose plan of moving to the States as a young immigrant woman by myself would pan out. I'm trying to think what the other fear would be. Maybe a little fear of fitting in, but it was more fear around my livelihood. Could I support myself in this nation? And so I knew, therefore, how I communicated to my audience, especially in these. I didn't worry about being accepted by my new San Francisco friends. Everyone seemed to love me. I was interesting. I'd come in off plane from Tokyo and I had a New Zealand accent. So everyone seemed to love me. I had no problems making friends, but my biggest fear was, could I convey my confidence and my experience effectively to a decision maker who would hire me and give me a job? I knew I was brave and confident, but I didn't sound that way when I had all this imposter syndrome, cultural confusion swimming in my head. And it would hit me like a slap in the face as soon as I walked into that interview. The interview would trigger all the confusion and the worry.
Okay, so there's a fear, anxiety, you know, stress based on, you know, the 5 years that you spent in Japan with totally different environment. So the question that I would have for you in that situation, how could your Japanese experience be converted into a gift, an opportunity for you, even in San Francisco? What was positive about that experience?
I would say that I taught myself to read and write 1,000 kanji, which is the Chinese alphabet of the Japanese language. So I have a strong memory. I have strong discipline. And I guess I was 26 then, and now I'm 50. But back then, if I'd been wiser, I probably would have pointed out my ability to do what you were describing earlier, mold myself to fit into different cultures, that I hadn't realized that was actually a very important skill that I had cultivated as a young person. I mean, being the only foreigner in a company of 1,200 Japanese people, this is not an easy thing to do, but I did it. And I was there for the American guests when they came in. The company was Shackley Worldwide and the headquarters were in San Francisco. So when the American guests came in, I was a segue between a liaison. Then I was translating brochures from Japanese to English to send to the US head office. But I was also, I was culturally nimble, I would say. And that was really the gift of that time and very resilient.
So, you know, the Japanese experience has been seminal to you on various respects. You know, so you were nimbler, you know, more resilient, more disciplined, memory. So the gift, that's what we call the gift of knowledge, which you can then take in any environment, including San Francisco, but also the gift of power in yourself, meaning that you had to learn those Japanese signs. So discipline, you know, self-restraint, self-command, self-control, all the good things that are useful in life, whatever you do, so including in San Francisco. So we as coaches help people shift from a survivor brain, which is ruled by fear, anxiety, stress, guilt, all negative emotions, which reside in one part of the brain, which we call the survivor brain, which is fight or flight, shift people towards another part of the brain, which is what we call the sage brain, which sees opportunities, which is the part of the brain that is creative, that sees, says yes to new things, whereas the survivor brain is trained, programmed to say no to everything and to preserve the status quo. Because when you live in fear or in anxiety, stress, you're not predisposed. You don't want to explore options that take you away from your comfort zone.
That's right. I wished I'd known you back then. And I would have hired your services. So I had one more question and then I'll ask you if you have anything additional to add. So in our time, in this pandemic time, we're towards the end, but travel restrictions still exist. When you're seeking your customers and coaching your customers, how are you able to persuade them to use your coaching to help them navigate business cultures, given that international travel's gone down somewhat? I know already within the States, there's still a lot of domestic travel and transitioning going on, especially through the pandemic. I think a lot of my clients have chosen to leave jobs or take on new careers. This time has given them the opportunity to reflect on what they really want. So I wondered, how might you persuade those listening to our conversation today to bring in a business culture coach like you who's helping others navigate different cultures?
I think despite of the pandemic, multinational companies need more and more people with a level of cultural flexibility, cultural intelligence to lead their global departments. So the pandemic is not permanent. It's a temporary event. But the future, if we use positive intelligence, the future is bright. We don't really want to languish. We want to flourish post-pandemic. But that requires positive intelligence. So it requires people who have a future-minded optimism, people who have efficacy, meaning that I am able to do things, I am able to reach objectives, and also people who have who can imagine a different future. So if these conditions are met, these three components are met, then the process of globalization will carry on, will continue. Because it's, you know, from the times of, you know, Adam Smith, the philosopher, Scottish philosopher of the late 18th century, we know that people, you know, specialize in certain skills and sell those skills or those products and services to somebody else. So, you know, you can't produce wine in Scotland, but you can import wine to Scotland. So I think, you know, cultural intelligence, regardless of the pandemic, will always be useful, you know, so because we need to interact with China, for example, with the emerging powers, or India, for example. And if you go to a Anglo-Saxon business school like I have done, you learn about 360-degree feedback, you know, empowerment, open-door policies. But this is, if you go to a business school in the Anglosphere, if you deal with people from Saudi Arabia, these rules do not apply. That's why cultural agility becomes important.
So true. So true. And I wondered if there's anything else you want to add at all, Luca. It's been so lovely chatting with you today.
So I think what you said earlier about I wish I had a coach when I was 26 in San Francisco, I can relate to that, Debbie. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I wish I had a coach when I was in that period, you know, post-university, early work experiences, because if I had a coach, I would have avoided a lot of mistakes, or a lot of faux pas. So I recommend investing in coaching, you know, despite the resistance of certain cultures. I think a good coach can help you out, but a great coach can change your life.
So true. So true. And just think of any big life transition, even moving to the state of Wisconsin from North Carolina was a huge culture shock for me, completely different culture to adjust to. And I wasn't a coach at that time and I didn't have a coach either. But again, I would say for the rest of my life, I have a coach and I coach with her every week. But I would recommend to my children and friends, anytime any big life transition comes up, hire a coach, because so much time, we waste so much time worrying, don't you think? And the lies of our judge become so loud during times of change. The amount of lies my judge told me in that transitional time when I was trying to get employment before my savings ran out, they were huge lies and they were very convincing and compelling. I completely fell for all of them and wasted a lot of time and just not being present out of sheer worry. So great talking with you today, Luca. Thank you for your time and your wisdom. It's such a pleasure having you on the show. And you've been listening to The Sage Sayers. I'm Debbie Gardner-McCullough. If you'd like to visit my website, you can go to hangingrockcoaching.com. And Luca, share your website with the team.
www.believingcoaching.com.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll speak with you next week.